Good morning, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is John D. Hefner. I am counsel for Indiana Boxcar. Indiana Boxcar is a short line railroad holding company. It is a mom and pop operation, literally. It currently owns three railroad companies. It doesn't own any rail lines. It's not a railroad common carrier.
It was a husband and wife, I thought.
It is. It's, well,
it's a mom and pop.
The owners, Judge Randolph, are Mr. Powell Felix, who is here in the audience, and Mrs. Felix, who is not here. It owns no rail lines, it is not a railroad common carrier, and no railroad or railroads have ever owned an interest in Indiana Boxcar. It does work for what I call unaffiliated or third-party customers. In other words, state transportation agencies, rail shippers, and other railroads having no corporate relationship with Indiana High Rail. Indiana Boxcar, Indiana High Rail was a previous entity that Mr. Felix was involved with. Indiana Boxcar's employees, for their railroad activities, and when I say, and what I'm referring to is Mr. Felix and his daughter, when they perform services for the subsidiary companies, they do so on the payroll of the subsidiary companies, and railroad retirement taxes are withheld from their compensation. When Indiana Boxcar performs work for what I call the unaffiliated or the third-party clients, that work is compensated by Indiana Boxcar as opposed to the individual railroads and is subject to FICA or Social Security tax. Now,
tell me how much money is at stake in this case.
Judge Randolph, I can't, but I can tell you that only two employees are involved. So we're probably dealing with a fairly modest amount of money, but I don't know that answer, and it's not in the record. Yeah. This appeal presents the question, and it's really an industry-wide question that my colleague, Mr. Lane, will discuss. The question of whether a closely held short line railroad company, railroad holding company, that owns no rail lines and is not a common carrier, is subject to the jurisdiction of the railroad retirement law and related laws. The board wants this court to believe that Indiana Boxcar is subject to its jurisdiction because it shares officers and directors with its railroad subsidiaries. Now, it's really essential that this common control exists for the board to be able to find jurisdiction over Indiana Boxcar. And the reason is, there, as the board will probably tell you, there are two elements to finding coverage. One is the existence of common control, and the second is that the entity that is the subject here, namely Indiana Boxcar, provides services related to railroad transportation. And even the board itself admits at page 22 of its brief that if a company does not meet both of these criteria, then the board must find the company is not a covered employer. Now, in holding Indiana Boxcar covered, the board reversed, without hardly any explanation, 20 years of judicial and board precedent on the subject of short line or other railroad holding companies not being subject to its jurisdiction. And that key case, of course, is Union Pacific versus the United States, plus numerous, probably 20 board administrative decisions that apply the Union Pacific case. Now, the board's coverage ruling is erroneous in three principal respects. It departs from established precedent without providing an explanation. Second, it lacks a reasonable basis because it is contrary to the plain English meaning of the statute.
I think it's that plain.
I do. Yes, I do, Your Honor. and the Union Pacific case, both at the initial level and the Federal Court of Appeals level, said, yes, it is plain.
Well, I've read those, and I understand that, but it doesn't, just in isolation, I know you have a contextual argument as well about the surrounding language, which is helpful to you, but in isolation, is common control a term of art in this situation that excludes parent-sub relationships?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
What would you cite for that? That's asserted in the briefs, but I don't see a lot of supporting citation to tell us that this is widely understood to exclude parent-sub.
Well, in the Union Pacific case, both of the Union Pacific cases, the court there went, and in fact at the district court level, the my version of the case went on for 15 or 20 pages discussing the fact that you can't have common control between what amounts to a parent and a child, that you only have common control between sibling entities. Now, what the board has tried to do is to, and I thought, you know, they were very clever in this, what they tried...
The sub controls the parent, and the parent controls the sub.
But there is no common control between the parent and the sub. And I think that's the point that the Union Pacific case made.
What does the word common add when all you have is a parent and a subsidiary?
I'm not sure that the common adds anything.
Yeah.
Because there is no common control between a parent and a sub.
The same result would, under your theory, would apply if we struck the word common and just said control, right?
Actually, that's a very interesting question. It, as I think about it, it sounds almost superfluous because you wouldn't, I don't know whether or not you'd have, I guess you would have control by the parent of the sub.
The portion of the Court of Appeals opinion that you quote at page 20 of your brief says the term under common control does not usually apply to two companies in a parent-subsidiary relationship. What does that mean?
You know, I don't remember exactly why the term usually was used, or the word usually.
There weren't any citations after that either, which is goes back to my question, but you can continue with your answer.
Frankly, I want to give some thought to the question. But I will say, what the board has tried to do is use its regulations, the ones I believe it's, I want to say it's 20 CFR 202.4 and 5, to sort of fuse the parent and the subsidiary. And what they're basically saying is that when the chief executive or the management of the subsidiaries can essentially tell the parent what to do, and I don't know how many households the child tells the parent what to do. Maybe it's becoming more and more common today. But essentially they're trying to pierce the corporate veil. But as Union Pacific, which discussed those regulations at length, said, you can't do that. It's contrary to the plain language of the statute. It's contrary to the plain English meaning, the plain dictionary definition of common control, and they rejected the application of the board's regulations, which apparently go back to something like 1939.
Do you think that this language bars the idea of individual control?
The language of the regulations? I think, Your Honor, Judge Brown, it was meant to refer to the sibling relationship rather than the parent-child type relationship. But the only court ruling that is pertinent on this point are the Union Pacific rulings. The Railroad Retirement Board in its brief cites numerous other court cases, but not a one of them deals with the parent-child relationship, but rather either a railroad company that owned as the subsidiary that provided services to the railroad company, or this more parallel situation where you've got a company, sort of a parent company on the top, and then one or more railroad company subsidiaries and one or more non-railroads that were at, again, the subsidiary level that were providing services to the railroads.
Is that contrary to Union Pacific, the way you just stated that? I'm sort of baffled here because I thought in reading the excerpts from Union Pacific, that the court is saying that if all you have is a parent company and one subsidiary, that even then the subsidiary is not under common control. It has to be more than one subsidiary, and I'm just wondering why that makes any sense.
I believe, Your Honor, Judge Randolph, in some of the other decisions, some of the board decisions, they dealt with the case of a single railroad subsidiary under a holding company. In the Union Pacific, I believe there were about four or five subsidiaries, only one of which, the Union Pacific Railroad Company, was a railroad. So the third point I want to make is that there is, in terms of the services provided, if there were any services provided, basically Mr. Felix had two hats. One, he had his hat as a railroader providing services to the railroad subsidiaries, personally providing them to the railroad subsidiaries on the payroll of the railroads and subject to railroad retirement taxes. And then he provided, or I should say Indiana Boxcar provided, services to what I call the third-party clients, the government agency clients, the other short-line railroads with whom he had no corporate affiliation. Indiana Boxcar had no corporate affiliation, and some shipper clients.
Can I ask you a question about your first point? So I understand your statutory argument, but your other argument is that the board changed position without properly explaining that.
Yes, Judge Kavanaugh.
But it isn't one way to read the board's opinion that it carved out an exception to a broader principle that had been established in Union Pacific and in some of the subsequent cases, and it's carving out an exception, if you want to use that word, for closely held situations. And so therefore, what would be gained? Again, I understand your statutory argument, but put that aside for the moment. What would be gained by a remand for the board to say that in a few more paragraphs?
It seems to me if the board wants to change the law, instead of changing the rules of the game in the middle of the game, what the board could do is, like other administrative agencies do, they could hold some sort of a rulemaking, they could entertain comments from the public, and then they could reverse their position. And if you look at the 20...
They don't have to do it by rulemaking.
They could...
And what's your support for that?
It seems as a matter of...
Communication, they can certainly overrule their precedent, right, as long as they explain that they're doing that.
They barely explained it. They didn't cite any cases. They merely said, well, it's not publicly traded, but as you may know, BNSF Railway, I think the court can take official notice of the fact that as of a few years ago, BNSF Railway is no longer a publicly traded entity. Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, owns it, lock, stock, and barrel. And does this mean that every time a railroad either goes public or private or back and forth and back and forth, and I think Mr. Lane will discuss this at more length, that there's a change in their railroad retirement coverage situation?
Right. And I think that blends into your statutory argument that there can't really be this middle ground in the statute the way the board, and I understand that argument.
I'd like to reserve several minutes after the board gives its argument, please. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ronald Lane for the American Short Line and Regional Railroad Association. Many people find it surprising today that there are more than 500 small railroads in this country. 440 of those are members of the Short Line Association.
So there's, to pick up on Judge Randolph's question, there's how much money's involved, and overall, I know the specific case, we don't know.
I couldn't tell. What I do know is that there are approximately 50 privately owned holding companies that own railroad companies, and how many employees those holding companies have, probably 10 to 20, some number in that range. It's not a huge number in terms of taxes. What it's a bigger issue, frankly, is that this is, we're talking about pensions here. We're talking about not just taxes, but people's pensions. Pensions that are earned over a span of 5 to 30 years. And if you, when we have a situation like this where we're making a change in the pension system for employees based on the change in ownership or the ownership relation among the holding company's owners, it has a drop-down impact on the employees and the employment situation, the employment expectations of this industry. And that's why it's very important, and that's why I'm here, to make it clear that this is an important issue for the entire industry. We've had 20 years of settled law. We have designed companies and corporate structures. We've designed financing. We've designed liability schemes, all based on holding company structures that are common in other industries as well as the railroads, and understanding what the tax impact of those structures is. Now the board is summarily changing the rules that industry was built upon. I wanted to address Judge Randolph's question about individual control, or maybe it was Judge Brown, I'm sorry. this is not a situation where an individual controls a company. The ownership of this company is 50-50, it's two people. Two shareholders. These are shareholders. They're not individuals. Some railroads, a few, very few, are actually owned by individuals. And if I own a railroad, A, and I own a railroad, B, or I own some other entity, B, and it does work for the railroad, that's common control by an individual. But if I choose, as most people do in this country, to conduct my business through a holding company, because I have personal liability and a lot of other good reasons, I set up a holding company. The holding company owns different enterprises. I need to have the ability to sell my holding company to someone else. I need an exit strategy. I need to be able to finance. And so that holding company is a vehicle for many legitimate purposes other than taxes. And the reason that this is not a threat to the tax system is because the railroad retirement tax has two kinds of coverage. It covers employers and imposes a tax on employers. It also covers individuals, employees. So separately, people who perform railroad work, regardless whose payrolls they're on, regardless what the name is on the paycheck they receive, if they do work that is integrated into the railroad under the control of the railroad, they are deemed to be employees for purposes of tax. And they are taxed, and they can earn benefits if they continue to work enough years in that kind of capacity. So an independent contractor can be an employee, a tax-deemed employee, an individual, a sole a practitioner of some sort, can be an employee and be taxed. And in fact, that's what's happened here. That's why Mr. Felix and his daughter paid railroad retirement taxes. They would have been deemed to be employees of the railroad when they're doing work for the railroads.
Can I ask one question? In the 20 years or so since this has been settled, in, yes, in your view, has there been any effort in Congress to change the law?
No. No, there's not. And this has been applied consistently by the board as well as by the court. I mean, there are a whole number of cases that we've cited.
There have been people disagreeing on the board, and that's why my question was, has that led to,
no,
okay, we can't get a change at the board level, let's try to change it in Congress?
No, it's never done. And you know, this statute is a peculiar statute. It's one of several that were formed by agreement of labor and management back in the 30s. The statute resulted from an agreement. This Eastman, who was quoted in the brief, was appointed by the president to sit down with labor and management and negotiate a statute. It was after the predecessor statutes had been declared unconstitutional. And they said, get together, you guys figure out a retirement system for railroad employees. They negotiated a system. It was enacted by Congress, and that's what we're dealing with here.
It sounds like you're making an argument that if the board wanted to change the system, that they should, first of all, grandfather in all the existing arrangements and do it only by regulation and make it prospective only. But
if the board wanted to change it, frankly, they should go to Congress. At this point, this is settled law, and it's Congress should change the system, and not the board. One further observation. The impact of the board's decision is that it taxes employees who do not do railroad work. Understand, the holding company employees who do railroad work are covered as employees, deemed employees of the railroad. So the only people who are affected by this decision are those employees of the holding company who don't do railroad work. And I submit to you that it's a pernicious interpretation of the statute.
But as you've described it, this is a fairly complicated statutory scheme. What role does deference play here?
None at all, Your Honor. And I would point out, as I'm sure you're aware, there are two agencies that interpret and apply this statute. The Railroad Retirement Board pays the benefits under railroad retirement. The Internal Revenue Service collects the tax. The Internal Revenue Service has indicated in all of their documents to their auditors that Union Pacific is the law, and it's been applied consistently by the
IRS. IRS also says that it will follow the interpretation that the Railroad Retirement Board gives. So I don't know that there's a potential conflict so long as the IRS says we're going to leave it up to the board.
Well, the IRS has said that in most cases they'll give deference, but they reserve, of course, the right to have their own view if necessary. And I don't know what they would do in this case, frankly, but they lost, and they are bound by the decision in the Court of Claims in the Federal Circuit. They were the party, and they're bound in that case. And so we definitely have a conflict situation if you were to uphold this decision. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Kelly Johnson for the Railroad Retirement Board. At the outset, business aside, this is a closely held company with one person, controlled by one person. Yes, it's a husband and wife, but the facts clearly show that Mr. Felix controlled the operation of all the companies. Secondly, I want to point out that Union Pacific case is a tax case, is not a coverage decision issued by the three-member board.
But if we disagree with its reasoning here, that will be a clear circuit split. The Supreme Court would have to resolve, don't you agree? It would be a circuit split, at least.
With respect to, we do acknowledge
on the interpretation of the statutory provision at issue here.
As far as the Union Pacific case?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we were to agree with the board, then we're disagreeing with Union Pacific, aren't we?
No, the cases aren't even similar, and that's why there will not be a split. Union Pacific case, we agree that when there's a parent and a subsidiary that there is no common control. We agree with that factor. But common control stopped when it reached Union Pacific, as that was clearly the parent and then Union Pacific, if I'm correct, owned over 30 subsidiaries. Mm-hmm. But the board had issued many decisions that common control is not present in cases where there is a parent and subsidiary. However, this case is different. Control is not in Indiana Boxcar, as in Mr. Felix. And we've held, and if I'm right, there have been court cases that said it could be more than just a company, it could be an individual. Mr. Felix is, in essence, this case version of Union Pacific. Mr. Felix controls Indiana Boxcar, who ultimately control the subsidiaries, thus finding that Indiana Boxcar is under common control with its railroad subsidiaries, because they're all, it's a commonality. There's different forms. There's parent and subsidiary control, as you found in Union Pacific, and then there's also the grid of the parent and then two subsidiaries, and those two subsidiaries, for example, or more, are considered under common control under the parent. Then there's also the version which is here. There's Mr. Felix, Indiana, who owns 100% of Indiana Boxcar, and in turn, Indiana Boxcar owns 100% of five railroads, and then 50% of one. So Indiana Boxcar and the rail subsidiaries, Chesapeake, Vermilion, Youngstown, in Evansville, are all under the common control of Mr. Felix. So with that being said, the elements of...
The board's interpretation of common control here, which allows some parent sub relationships to be brought in, but not all. First of all, how can you draw that distinction from the statutory language that some parent-sub relationships are controlled but not all? It would seem to be all or nothing.
No, I think that each case needs to be decided on the facts themselves. There have been cases we found that cases like publicly held corporations are not under common control with its subsidiaries. Then we also found where there's a holding company that is owned by several individuals or another company is found to be under common control or not under common control. It's just it's really a case by case. I don't think that the court should be left here thinking it's all or nothing. I think it's a case by case matter. This particular case is, to me, not the test case for Union Pacific. This is one individual who controls the holding company as well as the subsidiaries that the holding company owns.
Obviously, there was a dissent that viewed this case in the, at the board that viewed this case as inconsistent with Union Pacific.
Well, the management member feels that it should apply to privately held as well as publicly mm-hmm. held. And as you see in the past 20 years, that the board has really been divided on where Union Pacific falls. It's just so happens in this case that the management member is the dissent in this case, and he
right.
feels that Union Pacific should be applied across the board.
I understand your position that if you had a holding company that had 100 employees, mm-hmm. and only one of them did any kind of railroad work, and that holding company was owned by one individual, mm-hmm. and there were, I don't know, five railroad subsidiaries, right? Mm-hmm. Plus other companies, that in that situation, all 100 employees on the holding company would be under the railroad retirement system? Why does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't make sense. I mean, what we're going to look to is the type of work that's being done. We're going to look at the effort of that company and the type of work it provides to its subsidiaries.
And the only difference between the hypothetical I just gave you and the situation we have here mm-hmm. is that I hypothesized 100 employees. You don't have that situation here. But
I
don't see where your reasoning turns on the number of employees within the holding company.
Well, I think that it's not about the number, it's the type of work itself. Now, in this particular case, there were two employees, which I'll address in a minute, but I think we're going to look at, if you have that scenario that you just explained, we're going to look at the effort of work. Now, if you have 100 employees and they're all, 99 of them are doing work that is unrelated to the railroad industry, but you have that one individual, we're going to take a look at the type of work that that company does for the subsidiaries. We're going to look at the revenue that it brings. Does the subsidiaries solely rely on the holding company for those services?
The subsidiaries, under your theory, and the parent are under common control, and therefore the statute requires them to be under the railroad retirement system. I don't understand. Why, where in the phrase under common control, there's any room for the idea that, well, if you've got a 99 employees not doing railroad work, we certainly don't want to bring them under the umbrella.
And definitely, we agree with that. I mean, Judge Randolph, you have to look at each case as fact specific. Your factual outline may bring a different outcome. Because
how?
Of the type of work that's being done by that company.
Excuse me, please don't interrupt me
when I'm trying
to interrupt you.
You go first.
Okay, but would you tell me the reasoning that you would go through to exclude the hypothetical holding company I just gave you?
I think it would go to, you're saying that there would be one owner, a company that has 100 employees, one employee provides exclusive services to the subsidiaries.
Right.
Right. Those are the facts that we're going to take a look at. And at that point, the board will make a decision of whether the work itself, the revenue, the effort, the percentage of time that it provides to the subsidiaries and determine if control is there as well, if it's still under common control. This particular case is
It would be under your theory, wouldn't it? I mean, if you had one individual that owned both the holding company and the subsidiaries, then under your theory, that all the parent plus the subsidiaries are all under common control?
And it is possible. I mean, if that particular owner who owns the holding company as well as the subsidiaries is actively involved, for example, like Mr. Felix, he's president of every company, and he's able to deal with the day-to-day operations and determine what today the company, each company will do and what it will not do, then that's going to be further evidence of the control factor, of the common control.
On the statutory interpretation issue of common control that you gave, mm-hmm. it seems that there are a couple responses that I want you to address. One is that the board's interpretation would make redundant or surplusage the other language that does refer to a particular kind of parent-sub relationship. So that's one. And two is that the same Congress that enacted this statute also enacted the Securities Acts that would make crystal clear that this kind of relationship was covered. And so while common control may be ambiguous in isolation, it becomes not ambiguous when you look at it in the context of the other language in the statute and the Securities Acts. Can you address that?
I'm not familiar with the Securities Acts. I think that the main issue here is that the intent of Congress was to make this more expansive than, for example, the Railway Labor Act.
True, but how expansive is the question? And so just because Congress wanted to make it more expansive doesn't really tell me much about how to address this.
Well, I think the focus should be that with, for example, the Railway Labor Act, as I was saying, mm-hmm. dealt with labor management and negotiations, and so they wanted to limit the reference of carriers. But there is clear legislative history where they wanted to make this more expansive. For example, they cover rail labor organizations and then also affiliates, because back in the 30s and the 40s, railroad entities were very distinct, but now we're dealing with conglomerates. We're dealing with a railroad being within the corporate structure of a larger corporation.
Right, which is what the board's been dealing with. I guess this gets to my other concern, which is the board's been dealing with that, what you just described, for 20 years, and has come out the other way for 20 years, and now has changed, but shouldn't it have to explain that change, acknowledge, and then explain that change under basic administrative law principles?
Well, I think the board did explain it. I don't consider this as a change. I think that each case was reviewed based upon the facts that were presented at the time, and each of those decisions are final. This particular case, which happens to be the one so opposing, I think this is really one of the first cases where we're dealing with one individual controlling the holding company that provides services to the railroad, and in essence, he is the president of every entity. This is a very unique case. I don't consider it a change. I think the board is now fine-tuning how to apply Union Pacific. Union Pacific was a huge corporation, several hundred shareholders, and of course, control and was minimized, and so we agree with that point. But I think our explanation of the facts themselves is the explanation as to why the Union Pacific did not apply to this particular case.
So how many stockholders does a parent corporation need to avoid coverage? Five?
Well, that's an interesting concept, because I'm going to say there is no magic number. I think that, I understand that, but I think that, for example, my thinking is, let's say there's two. There's Mr. Felix and his wife. But we're looking at the fact that Mr. Felix really is the one who's operating the corporations. If there are five.
I don't know where you get the word really there.
He is operating. Okay. He is controlling.
Okay, but okay. If you expand it to five.
To five, then again, we have found that, you know, there's five, and so that may diminish it. We also found that there was one majority shareholder, but because there were board of directors and officers, that there was not control. I think that we will even look to the dynamics of those five. Are the other four involved in the operation in the day-to-day, or they're just investors and they leave it to one of the owners to operate the corporations? It really is going to depend upon each fact. Of course, the larger the number, then we'll say, well, you know, common control is not there, or more importantly, control is not there.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with the Delaware Otsego? Case. You didn't mention that in your brief, did you?
I did.
Oh, I looked in the index just now, or table of contents, and didn't find it.
Delaware is on page 20. 27.
So the facts of that case were that a single individual owned 80% of the holding company and then also owned the railroad subsidiary. And the board initially held that the holding company was in common control as a result, but then reversed itself.
Exactly. Right. And that's what I just spoke to Judge Kavanaugh, that with him, he was the majority holder of the 80%, but then there were board of directors and officers, seven board of directors, I believe, and five officers. So that diminished his absolute control. There was basically people he had to answer to. So he could not go in, like Mr. Felix, for example. He decided, I'm going to resign from Indiana Boxcar. So he removed himself from that. But that's not the same scenario in Delaware. So I think that—
Who appointed the board of directors?
I'm sorry?
Who appointed the board of directors?
In Delaware, I am not sure, but they existed. So
the one individual owned 80%.
Right.
Right? So the SEC defines control as 10%.
Possibly, but there were also two other railroads that owned collectively 20%. So more likely he would have had to sit with those representatives from those two railroads to determine who will make up the board of directors.
I don't think that's the way corporate life works, at least in my experience when I was practicing.
Yeah. It may or may not, but the bottom line is that when you have more people involved, of course this goes back to you, what you said, Judge Kavanaugh, that diffuses the issue of control and also common control. This particular case we're dealing where the Union Pacific does not apply, and it's not with respect to Indiana Boxcars that Mr. Felix is the one. He is threaded throughout the whole entities, every single one of them. And then most importantly, it wasn't just Indiana Boxcar was not just a holding company holding assets. It was an actively working company that provided services to its subsidiaries. And although that may not have been specifically stated, I'm pretty sure that the entities solely received services from Indiana Boxcar, and that's where we also meet the second prong of finding under common control as well as service and connection. This is not a change. I want to make this clear. This was a factual case, and this particular facts we found correctly that Indiana Boxcar is under common control with the rail subsidiaries, and we also found that service and connection was present as well.
Would you characterize it as a carve out from the rule?
I characterize it as the expansive language of the meaning of employer that Congress intended it to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Are there any other questions?
Sure.
Ask you one thing. Mr.
Yes.
Lane says that the board is not entitled to any deference in their interpretation.
I disagree. I feel that the board, this is what we're here to do. We're here to make determinations of employers and employees. This is a very complex and unique statute, the Railroad Retirement Act and the Railroad Unemployment Insurance Act. The purpose of this is to pay benefits. Where we receive Social Security benefits, these individuals who make up this industry receive benefits under both of these statutes. We're entitled to deference with respect to the fact that the language is unambiguous, as well as deference that this is a permissible interpretation. We have the regulations to further explain the meaning of common control, and we look to the type of power, and we look to who actually does the control. I think that to say that we do not have deference to make a decision based upon a statute that we have been administering for almost 80 years is not a strong enough argument to justify why we made this decision in this case.
You get deference only to the point where it's not inconsistent with the statutory language, obviously. You said you make determinations of employer, employee, that's what the board's here to do. I would add within statutory constraints.
Obviously. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Can you tell me on page 121 of the joint appendix, there's this paragraph which in the board's decision that says, I'm looking for it, that we have held, I can't find it.
We, 121.
I think that's a paragraph. I'm looking for the paragraph in which the board, I know it's in there, but in which the board says that since Union Pacific, we've held that in a situation comparable to the Indiana box car situation, we found common control. And there's the question, they don't, the board doesn't cite any of its cases. Can you tell, what cases is the board referring to? I may have the wrong paragraph. I thought that was it.
Okay, because I'm looking where it says that we found irreasonable in cases of publicly held corporations. As far as decisions, the closest...
Yeah. Okay. Yes. It's thank you, Judge Brown. It's the first sentence. We note the board has declined to follow Union Pacific and closely held corporate structures where control of the parent and subsidiary is clearly concentrated in a few individuals. What cases?
I'm sorry, sir. I just went back to that page. Which is the first full paragraph?
First full paragraph, and at the end, at the after the comma in the first sentence. The board has declined to follow Union Pacific and closely held corporate structures, et cetera, et cetera. What cases is the board referring to there?
If I'm correct.
I'm sorry, it's page 121 of the
joint. Right, I see what you're referring to. We have... I think Rail Investments Incorporated.
Which one?
Rail Investments Incorporated, where the company was solely owned by one individual who also owned a railroad. The majority of the board agreed that Union Pacific did not apply.
Can you give me the citation to that?
It is a board decision. As far as case law, there's not much case law on common control. And the case law that is there was involving more service and connection cases like Livingston, railroad cross ties. But this is a really untouched subject with respect to facts like this. But as far as I think the board was referring to its own board decisions, and that is in our addendum as well as the addendum for the amicus and the petitioner.
Okay, the name of that again was what?
It's Rail Investments Incorporated.
Okay, thank you.
And possibly that was found under common control. Look at the amicus.
I think they respond that case involved a commonly owned corporate sibling that provided services to an affiliated railroad, so I'm not sure that's...
There aren't any cases that are like on point as comparable, but there are different scenarios of common control cases. So I'm just trying to find the case to answer, Judge.
And there's some intermediate holding company cases, but this is
a very different case. Omni Tax Incorporated was a privately held corporation. There we did find that Union Pacific was indistinguishable because it controlled 11 carriers. And so it was, of course, the dynamics of the outlining of the company ownership. Then in State Rail Incorporated, we had a privately held company, holding company owned by another company. And the holding company owned 100% of a railroad. And then we found there that it was Union Pacific was indistinguishable. But as far as cases that we're dealing with, like Mr. Felix and Indiana Boxcar, this is so unique with respect to not only did he own Indiana Boxcar and the railroad companies, he also ran those companies. And that's where we're saying to take it a step above Indiana Boxcar and in essence find Indiana Boxcar under common control. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Did Mr. Hefner have any time left? All right. Mr. Hefner, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Judge Brown.
I'd just like to make a few points to set the record clear on a few issues. First of all, with regard to whether or not Union Pacific was a tax case. One of the cases that the Railroad Retirement Board cited, I believe a name, something like TransServe, was a tax case, a request to recover back taxes that were paid, I guess, under protest. Now, there is a case that is directly on point, and that is CJX, or it may be called Mississippi, Tennessee, something or another. It's attached to my reply brief, and I should also add that of the roughly 20 or so cases, and I think that my colleague, Mr. Lane, in his brief, had a list of pertinent Railroad Retirement Board cases that upheld Union Pacific. I know every one of those cases. In most cases, I know every one of the people involved. And so it's incorrect for the board to say that Indiana Boxcar is a unique case unto itself. Also, there's nothing in the record that suggests, that even discusses whether Mr. Felix totally controls Indiana Boxcar, or he and his wife control Indiana Boxcar, or what the arrangement is. There is no effort or attempt by Mr. Felix to take him or his daughter out of the railroad retirement system, which is usually one of the concerns the board has, because he's paying railroad retirement taxes on the salary checks that he gets from each of the subsidiary railroads. Apropos of the comparison between Mr. Felix and the Union Pacific, that's an incorrect comparison. Mr. Felix really corresponds to the investors in Union Pacific, the I don't know how many thousand people in the world who might own shares in Union Pacific. So from a structural point of view, you'd have Mr. Felix on the top and the Union Pacific shareholders on the top. Then below it, you'd have Indiana Boxcar below Mr. Felix, and then below the few million Union Pacific shareholders, you'd have Union Pacific Corporation. Then below Indiana Boxcar, you'd have the Youngstown and Southeastern and the, I think it's called Vermilion Valley or something like that, Railroad. And under Union Pacific Corporation, you'd have the Union Pacific Railroad plus a bunch of other companies. So that's not really comparable. And with respect to Delaware Otsego, I know that company. I know the man who used to be the 80% shareholder, now deceased. And I can assure you that he ran the show, no question about it. And rail investment cited by the board is not good precedent, as are some of the other cases that she either mentioned or alluded to, because in each case, they were that involved in rail investment. You had a holding company, or excuse me, you had a collection of individuals at the top of the ownership chain who owned a holding company and owned a short line railroad. The facts are a little confusing in that case. So you actually did have common control between the non-carrier entity and at least one railroad. And some of the other cases, you have what you might call the holding company and then the son of holding company. In other words, two holding companies in the chain. And what usually trips you up in Railroad Retirement Board circles, and forgive me for putting it that way, is when you have a holding company at the top of the chain, then you have another holding company in the chain, and then sometimes you have one or more railroads that are on the same level of the platform as the subsidiary holding company. That's Patriot Rail. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
So the second holding company and the subsidiaries of that second holding company are in common control.
Yes, sir. Yes, Judge Randolph.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heffner. The case will be submitted.
Thank you.